All right, it's been an excellent discussion, and there's quite a few points to come back on, and a couple of things I didn't get to mention in my initial lead-off. But yeah, just going backwards from what Daniel was talking about, actually, ironically going backwards, I want to talk a bit about reversibility and irreversibility. One of the actual fundamental progressions on Newton's ideas was actually the idea that there was a kind of arrow of time, if you like, within Newton's kind of clockwork universe, was an idea that actually everything was kind of reversible, that basically the laws of motion could play out in one direction, or you could just turn them backwards. And actually it was entropy that Daniel mentioned, the idea of entropy, the idea that there is a kind of a complexity and that entropy is always is created, if you like, that gave a kind of an irreversibility to processes, that showed that actually there is a certain arrow to time, if you like, and that time is something very real, therefore, and not something that can be, you know, we can't talk about eternal processes that exist somehow outside of time, that, you know, change is inherent and development and evolution and so on. But one of the conclusions actually of this idea of entropy that Daniel actually touched upon was this idea that, you know, that actually the universe itself would end up in a cold death, basically, because there's always a lack of nothing's ever 100% efficient, if you like. You're always going to generate heat, generate entropy, and eventually the whole universe will just settle out down into a kind of cold state where there's no motion anymore, and it's just a kind of cold death of the universe, they called about it. And actually, again, it shows you know, this kind of pessimistic, nihilistic outlook not only reflects the kind of nihilism of the society we live in, but also it shows you the kind of idealism, again, of this stuck in the Newtonian method, the idea that somehow we're in a closed system, it's just an irreversible kind of process, actually, of death and decay. And actually, as Daniel pointed out, real processes, of course, have processes of ebb and decay, but then also of life and of creation. You know, the universe we see really around us isn't one of just constantly greater and greater disorder, if you like. But that actually, you do have processes that go in the reverse. You do have a move in evolution from simplicity to complexity. Within the universe itself, you see creation and destruction existing alongside each other. Black holes, for example, once thought to just to kind of swallow up matter and energy, and now it's seen they also emit, they also create, and they're actually at the center of galaxies and therefore of life in general. So it's again this unity of opposites. You know, the universe is not an isolated system like the kind of second law of thermodynamics is supposed to apply to. And actually, therefore, you can't make the same assumptions about the universe as a whole as what you can when talking about an isolated system. The second law of thermodynamics, which talks about, you know, things getting more and more into a state of disorder and so forth, actually only applies to closed systems. The universe is infinite, and therefore the whole the kind of science behind it doesn't apply so much. Scott and Mark talked about kind of quite interesting similar questions, actually, about the kind of slightly positive role, if you like, of quantum mechanics, and also the slightly positive role Mark mentioned of Mach. Actually, Lenin actually wrote a criticism of Mach, actually, in his book Materialism and Imperial Criticism, because actually Mach, whilst he influenced, he made some, you know, important kind of philosophical breakthroughs in terms of talking about relativism and so forth, which obviously influenced Einstein. Nevertheless, he was a subjective idealist, actually, who kind of who went so far as to say, you know, like, well, you can obviously get a hint of this in Einstein, where the idea that the observer somehow changes time and space according to the speed they're going at, or the different affects time and space by the observer's own viewpoint. There's a hint of kind of subjective idealism there, of the subject determining the objective reality. But that, and that's actually, that kind of hint of subjective idealism comes from Mack, actually, who did subscribe to this idea of the kind of, you know, if I close my eyes, then the world around me ceases to exist. And there's actually that there's a bit of a tension, therefore, always actually within the kind of philosophy of science between the kind of subjective idealism you get of quantum mechanics that says, you know, we interact with the nature to the point where we actually kind of are the primary force in nature, you know, and if we close our eyes, nature ceases to exist. There's that kind of tendency on the one hand, that extreme, but then obviously the extreme on the other hand to say that we're completely separate from nature, that there's a complete dualism between man and nature. And obviously, you know, it shows you how if you obviously push any philosophy to its extreme, it actually turns into its opposite. And therefore, you know, if you push the monist or materialist view to its extreme in the sense of, say, you know, we are part of nature, you actually end up at the opposite, which is to say we are primary before nature, if you like. So obviously the importance obviously is therefore to see it in a dialectical materialist sense. You know, of course we are a part of nature and we interact with it, but we're not in any way primary to nature. And obviously our knowledge is an approximation of nature itself. And actually that comes on something Ross mentioned as well, which is about the idea of, you know, in his laboratory, these scientists who assume that kind of our models are what are correct and that all our experiments must conform to our models. And actually, you know, and Ross pointed out that the fundamental problem there is obviously we're not in an isolated system. Our experiments don't exist in an ideal kind of Platonic world. And all of our experiments, all of our results are always approximations, always going to contain errors and so forth. And Engels made the very important point, quoting Hegel actually, the idea that necessity expresses itself through accident. In other words, the laws that we derive, the laws, the theories we derive, are precisely observed, not by seeing things that conform to our ideal, but actually from the opposite, from things that actually vary from the ideal. It's only by seeing all the kind of the variation that we see that we can then kind of draw a line through, if you like, and see a correlation and see some sort of kind of general tendency or scientific law. And if everything always conformed to the ideal, we'd never actually really understand the real mechanics behind something. It's only actually through a process of experiment, of changing different variables, of seeing how a change in a situation from an ideal creates something else, that we actually get a sense of really what's going on in that system. And actually, Engels makes a related important point on this, which is to say that knowledge for us isn't just a question of observation. You know, this is the kind of limitation of the empirical method, which says, you know, it's a very narrow individualistic method, which says I look at this and I observe this and I accumulate facts, and that's the process of science, what it is, rather than seeing it's not just a question of observing nature but of interacting with it. Actually, Engels points out real knowledge is not just knowledge that we observe, but it's knowledge that we it's manipulating nature to our own advantage, if you like. You know, real knowledge isn't just being able to observe a phenomena and kind of say, you know, if I do A, B happens. You know, that's a very kind of empirical way of saying, you know, if I do A, then B happens, and if I do B, then C happens. But that doesn't really give you a sense of actually how nature's working. That's just a kind of statistical relationship, relating some inputs to some outputs. Real nature, Engels points out, is actually being able to replicate a phenomena for yourself. In other words, be able to create the initial conditions for creating not only a phenomena that you observe, but new phenomena. You know, a real understanding of thermodynamics isn't just to say if you know that there is a relationship between pressure, temperature, and volume, and so forth. Real thermodynamics is being able to create the conditions such that you can turn the energy in steam into electricity, for example, something that doesn't actually occur in nature of its own accord. That's our real understanding of science, is how to manipulate nature, manipulate the laws that we see around us to our own advantage. And actually, that kind of brings me on to another point, which is about what we mean by Marxism as a science, and in terms of laws and the dialectical idea of laws. You know, often we call ourselves scientific socialists, and often you get attacked saying, you know, Marxism isn't a science, and it's often the people with a very narrow Popperian definition of science, Karl Popper, the idea who came up with the idea of science is only something that's falsifiable, something that's testable and falsifiable. Now the point is, with that very narrow definition of science, there's very little that you could actually call a science, and whole swathes of what we would consider, you know, sciences, geology, meteorology, medicine, all of these basically cease to be sciences. Of course, Marxism isn't an exact science. We don't have a crystal ball. We can't predict exactly what will happen. But obviously, like a doctor, we can at least look by studying the general history of illnesses and conditions and symptoms and diseases. We can understand how the body works and therefore try and prescribe a cure. Like the geologist, we can map out where the fault lines are and understand not exactly when an earthquake will happen, any more than anyone can predict exactly when someone will die as a doctor. But nevertheless, you can predict where it will happen and the likelihood of it happening, and make rough predictions within certain limits. And you have perspectives, if you like, with the weather. You know, how many times have we complained that the weather's not what it was predicted to be? But yet you would still call these people meteorological scientists. They still try and study the general dynamics of the weather in order to make predictions within certain limits. And it's the same as Marxists. You know, we don't have a crystal ball. We can't say exactly when revolution will happen. We don't know exactly when crisis will break out. But we can make generalized laws, if you like, about how society moves, about how consciousness changes, about how the economy develops. What are the dynamics of these things? That is our dialectical understanding of the laws in history and in the economy, like the dialectical laws that we extract from nature by observing the real process in nature, by observing the real processes in history, the real processes in the economy, the real dynamics of capitalism. We can actually uncover the laws, not only of capitalism. Capitalism clearly has laws. There are boom and bust, and all these laws arise, precisely like all laws, from the interaction of within this system. You know, the laws of capitalism arise out of definite social relations, out of definite interactions of many people. You know, the fact that some of us have to work for a wage for a tiny minority means that certain laws arise. You have wage labour and capital, and from that private ownership and the production for profit, you get a boom and slump cycle. You get the crisis of capitalism. From the crisis of capitalism, you get revolutions. Mass movements that seek to change society. Because at the end of the day, if you are one of those people who has to work for a wage, you know, you are forced in a certain direction. If your material conditions get worse and worse, your only option is ultimately to seek collective action, a collective way out. And just as, you know, just as we acknowledge that there are certain biological stimuluses that we're unconsciously unable to avoid. You know, if you get hungry, it's because of your material needs and the hormones in your body telling you that you need to eat. But in the same way, you know, on many cases, on an unconscious level, people are driven to take action that they wouldn't normally take either. On a societal level, people are forced to take collective action, to unionize and to go on strike. And obviously that is the materialist explanation for history, for consciousness. Again, it's not a crude materialism where just because someone's conditions are deteriorating, they will automatically move in the direction of revolution. It changes in a dialectical way, but nevertheless there is a materialism behind it that forces people into certain conditions. And it was Engels in his pamphlet Socialism, Utopia and Scientific who pointed out it's precisely by understanding these laws in the economy that we can actually then manipulate them to our own advantage. Just as he said, you know, a real scientific law is not one that we just observe, but one of us manipulating nature. So a law in society, so a law under capitalism, by understanding that law, we can actually turn it to our own advantage. Under capitalism, Engels points out, the capitalist system, the laws of the economy are imposed on us. They do seem something external and omnipotent that we're unable to control, that we're unable, you know, we're forced to do things under capitalism. And he points out real free will, therefore, is understanding necessity. It's understanding the limitations imposed on you by these laws. And it's only by understanding that necessity we can manipulate them to our own advantage. I can't say I have free will in the sense that if I want to jump out the window, I can fly. Obviously, I can't do that. Like, there is a law of gravity that will pull me back down to earth and change my perception of free will very dramatically. But if by understanding the law of gravity, I can also build aeroplanes. And if I build aeroplanes, I can fly. And that's the whole point. If we understand the laws of capitalism, we can manipulate them to our own advantage and actually gain genuine freedom as a society. Just to sum up, my final point is that yes, ultimately, you know, the question of science, the barrier of science, is not just a philosophical one. It is a material one. It is an economic one. It is a question of capitalism that is a massive barrier to science. And again, it's not just us that say this. It's not just people in the room who've got their own personal experiences of you know, banging their head against the brick wall in the scientific community. I agree, like, with Scott's assessment of what it's like doing a PhD. You know, in many respects, you're just cheap labour. In many respects, I think PhDs is a very expensive form of Keynesianism. You know, it's a way of putting money into people's pockets. You know, it's the equivalent of digging holes in the ground and then filling them back up again a lot of the time. A lot of research these days is purely for the sake of research. And again, it's not just us saying this. There's a very interesting article in The Economist recently, which I think had the title something like "All Science is Bunk," or "The Majority of the Mass of Science is Bunk." And what that means is, for those who don't know what the word "bunk" means, basically it's nonsense, it's rubbish, it's trash. And the point they were making is that precisely due to the scarcity of funding within scientific research, there's a competition that's been created. Even within the public sphere, the competition that we normally associate with private ownership has entered into the public sphere. Academics are forced to compete against each other. If you want to keep your job, you have to publish papers. If you want to publish papers, you have to churn them out. You have to churn them out faster than the people in the university down the road from you, even though you're all funded by exactly the same taxpayers. I've seen this in my own research. We couldn't share data with our so-called competitors. You know, they were UCL, actually. That UCL had a massive data they wouldn't share with us, and we weren't allowed to share our data with UCL. Why? We're two publicly funded universities, but our academics are trying to produce papers faster than UCL's academics. And so we end up competing against each other rather than sharing the knowledge and the resources and the data we have to just ultimately solve the problems that society needs. So competition's been introduced, and the result of it is, what the Economist article pointed out, is a massive degradation of science. There's no verification going on anymore. There's no testing. It's people just churning stuff out for the sake of it. And included in that is a massive problem of actually falsifying results, of actually people fixing results just to be able to get papers in. They did experiments that showed one guy submitted a paper that was pure nonsense. Okay, he made it up from beginning to end, and it was just jargon and nonsense. And he submitted it to about 100 journals, scientifically peer-reviewed journals, and half of them let it in. Okay, and this kind of shows you like how far things are. There's no check and balance that you need in science anymore because of the race to the bottom, you know, the race to just produce and produce and produce for the sake of it. And therefore we can say, at the end of the day, it is capitalism itself that creates this scarcity completely artificially, that creates scarcity of funding through the cuts, through the austerity that capitalism demands. The logic of capitalism demands this austerity. It demands the cuts to higher education. It demands the cuts to research for the sake of research, to develop things for the sake of humanity, and instead imposes this race to the bottom. And as long as we have capitalism, therefore, It's not just this or that field of science that will be held back, but the whole of scientific research, and with it, the whole of humanity. And therefore, our task as scientists, as well as socialists, should be to fight against capitalism that is holding humanity back.